Welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim, your host. I am a little sick with something, and I've been spreading that everybody has been sharing in the suffering, including, sounds like, Andy.
You blessed me with whatever you've got.
Yeah, you'll probably be out of commission for about a day with fever.
I'm good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Chris has been an Iron Man. He's just not going down.
Yeah, it's to borrow a term from my boy Stagger, my awesomeness actually is working to defend me against sickness.
I have been known to say that.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, I've been waking up with a sore throat. Thank you, Steve Kim.
Sorry about that.
Steve aims to please.
So far,
he's a giver. He's very generous.
Yeah. Our voice sounds a little more raspy than normal.
Yeah, so pardon us today. But let's dive right into it. We have one announcement for you. The Apologetics Canada Conference is, again, coming up March 4th and 5th.
It's going to be good.
It's going to be awesome.
And we wanted to just highlight one keynote speaker who happens to be a good friend of ours, who really kind of took off, I guess, when he first got in touch with you a number of years ago.
Yeah, we gave J. Warner Wallace, we gave him his big break. He owes us. Yeah.
And you like to remind him
and
of that.
I do. Yeah, I do.
Awesome.
No, we got a great relationship with him. We had heard him doing radio with Greg Kokel back in the day down in Los Angeles, and we thought, you know, this homicide detective, he's a pretty cool guy. We should bring him up to the conference, and he was so thankful that we did. And he had a book coming out at the time called God's Crime Scene, and that book has done very well, and his popularity these days has exploded. He's flying all over, literally all over the place. I'm sure he's in the air right now heading to someplace to speak. Yeah. And we're privileged to have him for the conference. Mm-hmm. For those people who don't know about Jim, he's been a cold case homicide detective in Los Angeles for years. Mm-hmm. He's still, from what I understand, he consults still with the police department. And, you know, he brings a really interesting flavor to the discussion of, you know, apologetics, evidence for the faith. He was an atheist until he was 35. And then he began to investigate the evidence for Christianity, and it brought him to faith.
Mm-hmm. And he would tell you that he actually, his life was really good.
Yeah, that's an interesting part about Jim is he'll tell you his wife Susie, she's wonderful. Mm-hmm. He's got great kids. Like, he had a good life. He has a nice home, you know, in Southern California, right? You know, jogging on the beach each day. Like, life wasn't tough.
Well, successful career.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He never once lost a case.
Yeah, to this day, he's never lost a case. And in fact, you can see, I think he's done two on Dateline that you can watch, but where they've kind of shown the case. But at any rate, he came to Christ, you know, not because he needed a life transformation in the sense that, you know, his marriage wasn't doing well or he personally wasn't doing well, but that it was true.
Yeah.
You know, he came to Christ looking for truth.
Okay.
It's incredible.
Yeah. So that's who we're going to have as one of our keynote speakers.
And I think, too, it might be good to note that the movie God's Not Dead 2 is coming out in April. I actually just saw a bunch of promotion for that. And Jim is in this new movie, God's Not Dead 2.
I was wondering, how big of a part does he have? Like, is he like a prominent role, or is he?
No, it's not a prominent role. From what I understand, there's a court scene, and Jim is brought in as like an expert witness, and so there's a couple scenes with him in this courtroom drama.
Cool.
Well, I'll be keeping my eyes open for that. So that's one of our keynote speakers this year, so you don't want to miss out. The ticket price is actually going up at the end of this month,
February 15th.
February 1st it goes up.
Yeah, that's right.
But we have a discount code that can get you 10% off. So the discount code is THINKING16, THINKING16, and make sure you use that before February 15th. So if you want to get the best bang for your buck, you want to sign up now before the ticket price goes up and use the discount code to get further 10% off.
And I'll just say one last thing. Jay Warner is going to be at Maple Ridge Baptist Church the Thursday before the conference. And that would be a great event if you're looking to bring a non-Christian friend, somebody who's just wanting to investigate, does God exist? This is the perfect event to bring them to.
It starts at 7 p.m. on Thursday, March 3rd. at Maple Ridge Baptist Church. It's right on Lloyd Highway. You can look that up. And yeah, we hope to see you there as well. So moving on, Chris, you found some interesting articles on this one Nazi guy.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been some trendy news on a mm-hmm. Nazi we wanted to talk about.
Yeah, yeah, I read it in actually Time magazine, but there's actually been a couple over the last couple of years, and it's been in a few or all over the news, BBC, CNN, about Nazi collaborators or people that were in death camps that right. have been arrested, and they're bringing them to justice. And the latest one that I was reading about is about a 95-year-old man named Hubert Zafka, I think Zafka is how you pronounce it. Mm. And he was a medic in Auschwitz for 1 month during the time, or during 1944, and while killings were going on. And wow. So while he was there, 3,681 people were murdered, were killed yes. under his watch, or while he was there. So even though he wasn't in charge, and he wasn't evidently doing the one actually doing the killings, he was still complicit in that he didn't right. try to stop it, and mm-hmm. he knew what was going on, but there was no attempt at all on his part to do anything about it.
Over 3,600, that's like 10 people per day.
Yeah. And I mean, and who knows what's going, because I mean, they say 1.1 million were killed at Auschwitz. So you would think mm-hmm. that 3,600 was only in his little area of Auschwitz, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. So you would think that there would be more going on otherwise for them to get through that many people.
Oh yeah. They also had satellite campuses in which they were murdering people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. And so it's interesting though, I think, because it raises a lot of questions about the idea of justice. And
well, it's interesting, isn't it? I was actually talking to my son about this, because you know, even though he's young, he still gets the idea that this has been a long time.
Yeah.
And they're bringing, you know, they're being tried. And I was, you know, talking to him about how, you know, there's not a statute of limitations on murders. It doesn't matter when. You can still be brought to trial on a murder charge, whereas other crimes, you know, there's statute of limitations. There's a certain time in which, you know, you can't bring it to trial.
Statute of limitations, for those of you who don't know, is just it's a legal term for a period of time that elapses after a crime is done, and only during that time you're able to prosecute for that crime. For instance, I believe with most misdemeanor crimes and things like that, it's usually 5 years. Mm-hmm. Once 5 years passes, if you haven't been arrested, charged, or tried, it's a get out of jail free card, essentially. Mm-hmm. But with murder, it never exists. That's why you see guys like Jim Wallace. He's had a cold job case. As a cold case detective, right. because he would solve cases that were 30, 40 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah. And get convictions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is like amazing. We said, he's never lost a case. Now, what I thought was interesting about this article is I saw it trending on CNN, and particularly, they were also there's another guy that recently was tried, from what I understand. His name's Oscar Groening. And I recognized his name because if you have Netflix, there's a great documentary on Auschwitz that you can see.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, I'd highly recommend it. Mm. It's probably the best documentary I've ever seen. And Oscar is in this documentary. And what's fascinating about it is there's a lot of Nazis that went hiding after the war, and they right. did so successfully. Mm-hmm. And Oscar Groening was one of these. He ends up coming out, and he actually outed himself as a Nazi working in the concentration camp. And the reason he did that was because of the Holocaust deniers that is growing. And he wanted to speak out against it. Mm. So he came outed himself as being a Nazi that worked at Auschwitz. In fact, he worked in the financial department. He was one of the guys that would count the money from the inmates that were being murdered. All of their possessions were taken from them, searched mm-hmm. for cash. He collected it into the various different currencies, and then would send that off. And so he came out and said, no, listen, I was there and I saw what happened. Mm-hmm. And you know, mass amounts of people were murdered. What you know about the Holocaust is true.
Yeah. He says, I saw the gas chambers. I saw the crematoria. This was in the final, or talked about in the documentary, Auschwitz, the Nazis and the Final Solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the other things too that he said in the documentary that I thought was really interesting is because they were asking, how is this possible? How do the Germans kill all these people? And he said, you got to understand that it's a worldview. It's all about your worldview. You know, we had a worldview in which we saw the Jews in a certain way, mm-hmm. and that led to the killing. It's a fascinating interview. At any rate, after he outed himself, he was brought to trial and sentenced to 4 years in prison.
Yeah.
And how many people was it that they said he was responsible for?
300,000.
300,000. Wow. Which, I mean, so you have to ask yourself, how do they determine that he's responsible for 300,000 mm-hmm. deaths?
That doesn't mean that he actually literally killed 300,000 people.
No. It seems to me that it's based on the amount or when the period of time they spent there and how many people they can link to them during that time. Like, there's a nurse. Right. They linked 200. She was recently convicted for 260,000 murders, essentially, or accessory to murder.
Accessory to, okay, yeah.
You know, one of the things that was fascinating in watching the Auschwitz film, and you can, there's books that were written on this, is not just the men who participated in the killing, but the women and mm-hmm. how young they were. I mean, a lot of the Nazis that were hung after the war were in their early 20s.
Yeah.
Wow. And responsible for horrendous crimes against humanity.
What's what they talk about with Oscar Groening there? They mentioned that he joined the movement as a Hitler, what they called the Hitler Youth.
Right.
And then eventually the SS Waffen. But that they did most of the recruiting to young people, impressionable people that wanted to see change. Right. So, and we know that by the end of the war, the Nazis were equipping teenagers, like boys, to go out and fight because they had, and old men, because they had burned through essentially all their fighting men right. when they were fighting on two fronts against the Russians and the Allies in the West.
Right. And I think I'm probably going to butcher that Hitler quote, but he did say something about how he wanted to raise a generation that was just absolutely ruthless and brutal, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think he was successful in that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, just to give you one last little snippet that I thought was fascinating on Auschwitz, is that it actually, the camp actually came about, you know, like the Germans didn't have this idea at first about creating these factories of death. Mm-hmm. In fact, what they began to do at first in the war was just line people up on these pits, these Jews, mm-hmm. line up families and shoot them.
Right.
And it was actually Himmler that watched one of these in 1941. He watched one of these and realized, what kind of Germany are we going to have after the war if right. they participate in this kind of murder?
Mm-hmm.
Even though they hated the Jews, they still saw that this is going to have psychological effects
right.
on people, especially for the mass numbers that we want to kill.
Yeah.
And so this is what ultimately led to the gas chambers. It was actually a form of dehumanization. They wanted to further remove themselves from the killing. A lot of people don't realize this, by the way, but the Germans had what was called the Sonderkommando. And these were, what in German this is called, special agent. And these were made up of Jews. The mm-hmm. Jews did the dirty work in the gas chambers. Like mm-hmm. the Jews were the ones that were helping. So these Sonderkommando Jews, they were the ones helping the Jews into the gas chambers. Mm-hmm. They were the ones speaking to them, keeping them calm as they went into the gas chambers. And they were the ones that were collecting the dead bodies and taking them to the crematorium after right. they had died. In fact, the SS, the only thing that they really participated in was they were the ones who dropped the Zyklon B into the gas chamber. That was about it.
It's really disturbing how they did that, turning them in on themselves. And speaking of the Jewish people and how the Nazis worked that to try to get the, it's not really even culpable deniability, but it's trying to distance themselves from the
That was
the
more what it had to
yeah,
do with.
Exactly. Yeah. I remember when I was in the death camp Majdanek, much smaller camp outside of Lublin in Poland in 2010. I saw one of the pits and they had killed, and this was before, this was because they had crematoriums and gas chambers as well. But previous to that, they had shot 24,000 people over 2 days. And they showed us the big pit where they had, it was just a gigantic mass grave. And just, it's the chills that you experience being there. It's just insane.
Interestingly, on that BBC program on Auschwitz, they interview one of the Nazis that had shot
right.
people. And they asked him, they said, what did you feel when you were shooting those Jews? And he looked at the camera and said, I felt nothing. He said, I just thought to myself, aim carefully, shoot properly. That was it.
And this, I think this is where we, and Andy is doing a lot of work on this and speaking a lot about this, but this is, we could see this is sort of the direction our society could potentially go with some of the rhetoric that's going on right now with the dehumanization of people. We've had lots of conversations. Andy's spoken about this widely, but that's a big thing here at Apologetics Canada right now, is talking about this and trying to bring this to light.
Yeah, we don't have time to get into it. We're going to move on, but I will say one thing that I think in the area of apologetics we've got to do more of is not just fight against bad ideologies, but we need to denounce them as evil, or at least denounce them as dangerous,
mm-hmm.
right? The, there's a lot of ideas being bought in our culture today mm-hmm. that are not just false, they're dangerous. Yeah.
And this is why it's important for us to talk about this with the Nazis and to say it is good, a good thing that these men and women are coming to justice, because we need
Absolutely.
To we need to show that it's wrong and it needs to be, there needs to be some recompense, right? Like there needs to be something done.
Accountability.
Exactly. Otherwise, what's the point, right?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think we'll maybe come back to that topic some other day as well. I'm sure this will, as things unfold, there will be more to talk about as well.
Yeah.
So for now, we'll just move into the to another topic. So we're on this series called How Then Shall We Live? Last week, we heard from Chris mainly about spiritual discipline. So that was the heart portion of it. And today we want to talk a little bit about the head. I wrote that little blog article, I released it last Monday as sort of the introduction, where I told the story of looking at somebody like as a grade 5 student, looking at somebody in grade 11 and 12 or even in college thinking, oh, wow, you know, they're so far ahead of me, I'll never get there. But now that I'm on this side of life, I'm looking at them going, wow, they're still so young, and that gap between my grade 5 self and my college self, it's not that big. And the thought occurred to me that maybe it's like that in our intellectual life, right? You look at guys like J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig, or Craig Evans, and you think to yourself, wow, I'll never get there. In fact, when we had Dr. Craig come out a number of years ago for our conference, a lot of people were encouraged by his intellectual rigor, but also a lot of people were discouraged. They were just outright intimidated.
We had a number of people that didn't come back the next day.
Yeah.
Because they were like, well, this clearly isn't for me.
Apologetics clearly isn't for me. If this is what I need to be able to kind of understand. And
you know, it's kind of interesting. It's like as a culture, we're so used to the cookies being put on the lowest shelf that we're almost offended when we have to work for the cookie jar. You know, and I think that there's something to be said to that. You know, and it's kind of interesting. I've always used the analogy of working out. I've always enjoyed, you know, lifting weights. And one of the things that's an aspect of lifting weights is you lift till you can't lift anymore, mm-hmm. right? And then you try and you fail, but that's a part of working out. That's a part of improving your muscles and building muscles, is you have to go to that point that you fail and you push those limits and you see then where you are. And it's a matter of pushing past those limits, right? And mm-hmm. and at given time and effort, you can lift more weight.
Mm-hmm.
Intellectually, your brain is like a muscle.
Exactly.
It works the exact same way. You have to work that muscle.
Yeah, I find that a lot of people are afraid of memorizing things these days. And part of it, I guess, is because you know, especially if you've been out of school for a long time and you try to get back into it and you try to memorize certain things, it's not going to come to you easily, right? So you try it a couple of times and you find that you just turn around and forget it.
Yeah.
Right? And so then you get discouraged and go, oh, I'll never be able to do this. And they kind of give up, or we, I should say, kind of tend to give up. But I'm finding that the more you actually try to memorize things, even though you forget, your brain is still expanding, right? It's kind of pushing the limits. Because it's like just like you said, it's like a muscle, basically. So as you keep trying, even though you feel like you're failing, really you're improving.
Yeah, I remember I was telling somebody this the other day. When I was in college, I mean, I don't know about you guys, man, but I'd be reading or I'd be studying in the library, and the next thing I know, it's an hour later, and I've got drool all over my textbook, and I'm I'm violently waking up, you know, kind of going, where am I?
Just had the falling dream, and yeah, all of a sudden, yeah.
But it's funny, but though these days, you know, I can sustain reading or listening to a lecture or giving a lecture for much longer than when I was a young man. Mm-hmm. Like, but it takes time. It takes work. It takes effort.
Right.
And I've also noticed too, maybe you notice as well, Steve, mm-hmm. Chris, that you have to take in more than you're going to retain.
Right.
You know, you take in, you know, 10%. Like if you take in 10, you're going to keep about, I don't know, maybe 20%, right?
Yeah.
Of what you brought in, or mm-hmm. 2 out of 10 or 20 out of 100.
Yeah.
Yeah. The funny thing with memory too is that I remember reading a quick article on this. I don't know all the details, but one thing I did take away from that is that memory is not a matter of recollection. It is a matter of reconstruction. So for example, when you know, if we have just a bunch of random numbers or whatever, we're not going to be able to recall that in any sort of meaningful sense. But at the same time, we have no problem memorizing, what, like 100 names. Like look at teachers. I mean, Sarah, your wife, is a teacher, and she deals with how many students, and she knows their names.
Over 300. And she actually remembers a huge percentage of their names. She's actually shocked by it.
Yeah, exactly.
she's like, I'm going to remember like 20. And but yeah, no.
All the students who are listening to this are like, yeah, Steiger didn't remember my name. I tell you, that's been one of the biggest challenges for me teaching.
But the thing is, like, if you're, say, if you come from a big family where you have like 20, 30 cousins or whatever, mm-hmm. likely you know all of their names because you've spent time with them, or there is a certain trick to recalling their names too. For me, it's just matching the name with the face, right? If I can see the face and I know the name, it's so when I see the face, that leads me to your name or, mm-hmm. or something along those lines.
People
or,
do the repetition method.
Right. So,
hi, Steve. Nice to meet you, Steve. You know, you say the person's name 15 times in the first minute of meeting them.
That's how my wife actually does it. She'll do it in her head, though.
Oh, okay.
And that's one of the things I love about my wife. She's really intentional, right? Mm-hmm. She wants to know their name.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's kind of like a reconstruction exercise. So, apparently, early Greek orators...
Speakers, yeah, they used to do this.
Yeah, they had this technique where they would actually paint a very vivid picture of something, a room or something like that. And they would picture themselves...
Literally or in their mind?
Literally, in their minds, sorry. In their minds, they would picture a room and they're doing things, right? And all of the actions that they're taking or things they're seeing, things they're smelling, kind of sensing, touch, and things like that, those would all correspond to certain points in their talks. So they could do an hour-long thing or two-hour-long thing.
Lecture without using notes.
Right, without using notes because they had this technique, right? Because, again, it's a matter of reconstruction.
Yeah, it's interesting. In rhetoric, we would call this extemporaneous speaking when you only got like these bullet points that are going to remind you of what your next point is. Mm-hmm. But they were able to get rid of even the bullet points to remind you of the next point by having this memory technique where they would go through, for example, the rooms, mm-hmm. and they would know which room they're in their mind. And then they go into the next one, which will remind them of their next point as right. they're continuing their talk.
Yeah.
A lot of people use this method today.
Right. Another thing about memory too is that often we try to memorize it. So we come back to a certain word. For example, let's say you're studying another language and you're studying the vocabulary. So you would have the Spanish word and the English word, right? And you kind of go to it, look at it, try to commit it to memory, come back to it 5 minutes later, look at it again, come back to it 5 minutes later, look at it again, 5 minutes later, look at it again. But actually what I found works really well, and apparently there's some science behind this that I am not really aware of, is that you actually, that space gets longer and longer as you go. So what I mean by that is So what I do these days is if there is a word that I need to memorize, I'll look at it and I'll come back to it in 30 seconds. And if I see that and I remember it well, then I'll come back to it in a couple minutes. And I look at it. If it's a little fuzzy, I come back to it in another couple minutes. If it's easy, then I come back to it in maybe like 15 minutes, an hour. And apparently it gets to the point where if you see it once a year, you'll always retain it. So there a lot of flashcard apps that you can download these days, they actually do that.
Do you, Steve, use flashcards?
Yeah, I do. Flashcards all the time. In fact, here's a little tip.
It's kind of funny. I do as well.
Yeah.
It might surprise people. Often in the mornings, if there's certain things that I'm trying to remember, mm-hmm. I will flashcard it in the morning.
Yeah, flashcard. Again, because a lot of us are afraid of memorizing things, we kind of tend to shy away from it. But flashcards are actually really, especially if you have it on your phone, while you're waiting for your bus or while you're waiting in line at the grocery store, you can just turn it on and flip through a few of them. Mm. And that you'd be surprised how many you can go through in a day, right? Yeah. And
Steve, by the way, listeners need to know that Steve is like, he is a language god. It's ridiculous.
People, how about a guru is a god?
Demigod.
They sing songs of him in the hills.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. People, there are certain schools that they sing Steve's praise. It is ridiculous. They have a little statue of him. I'm kidding.
North Korea.
But no, like, this is some great advice from, like, if there's anybody who can do this and do it really well, it's Steve.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable.
The app that I use, I use a Samsung phone. So as an Android device. For Android, there's this great app called Anki, A-N-K-I, or I should say Anki because it's supposed to be Japanese. Anki, and it does exactly that, like I mentioned earlier. If you remember something, so you look at a word, you flip to the other side, you can choose one of the three buttons. Was it really hard? Was it really easy? Or was it so-so? And depending on your answer, that flashcard will come back after a certain amount of time. So if you say, oh, this was really easy, it won't show up again for like 3 days or something like that. And you can have some, I believe for iPhones as well, Evernote has released a flashcard app. So you might want to check that out.
One thing I want to say on this that I think listeners need to appreciate, and this is something that I wish I had learned earlier in life, is I used to have this idea that there were just certain people that were gifted, endowed with just intellectual prowess. Mm. And I wish I had been gifted with that, but they are. And we kind of worship them and we kind of, deify them. I know I was joking about Steve's ability with language, but we often will do that with people. I know for myself, William Lane Craig was one of those guys that I was just like, clearly, this man was, born from the womb with a brain twice the size of a normal human being. Right, or at least with twice the amount of brain cells.
The legend has it that the day he was born, he spoke Alvin Plantinga's name.
Like five people laughed at that joke. Okay, so I was one of those. There were three of them were in this room. But
who's Alvin Plantinga?
The thing, though, that really surprised me is, and I've said this before, is I have never met a genius. I've yet to meet one yet. Mm. Wherever I have gone, what I have met a lot of is people with an incredible work ethic.
Right.
People that have worked really, really hard, like William Lane Craig. I remember one time I said, you were put on a list of the 20 smartest people on the planet. And he laughed like out loud. He goes, yeah, I don't know why they do stuff like that. He goes, but as I've talked with him, as I've gotten to know him, he thinks that whole stuff is just ridiculous. What you'll find though with Dr. Craig is this guy works incredibly hard.
The man's a beast.
Yeah, he is. I mean, that's what we should really be more impressed with. In our culture, I don't think that we have a great enough appreciation for work ethic. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in our culture have this mythical idea that people are born brilliant. Right. And honestly, I have yet to find that. I've met a lot of people, a lot of great writers and thinkers. Gary Habermas has this method that he uses I think is quite interesting. Every time he has any chance to do some work, he'll do some reading or whatever it might be, or writing. He takes out this piece of paper. I've seen him do it multiple times. He takes out this piece of paper and he'll write down the amount of minutes or hours that he worked on a project. And at the end of the day, he counts all that time up, and he's constantly competing against himself to see how much he could put in this next day. Now that, I know it seems over the top and maybe is a workaholic, but it demonstrates this idea that these are people that they work really hard. Yeah. They put a lot of effort in.
Mm, well, wow.
I actually have a lot of other points that I just wanted to quickly shell out so people can just kind of take whatever works for them. But just a lot of it has to do with mindset. Some of it has to do with technique and things like that. So here are a few things that I came up with. I was told once, I believe it was Josh McDowell, who said, people use big words, but the big words actually have small meanings. And I find that a lot of the times you just get intimidated by the big words that you hear. But if you actually understood what that meant, you find that it's incredibly simple. For example, the thing that always makes me laugh is the Leibnizian law of the indiscernibility of identicals. It sounds incredibly academic, like yeah. It's ivory tower, tour de force kind of thing. But really, all that it means is if two things are in fact one and the same thing, what's true of one thing is true of the other. Mm-hmm. So all that it means is I am Sharina's husband as well as Maya's father. So whatever is true of Sharina's husband is true of
Maya's
father. And if there's a difference, right? If there's something that's true of Maya's father that's not true of Sharina's husband, then you can tell that these are not one and the same thing.
This is a good argument for the woman's body and the fetus, by the way.
Oh, yeah. So that's exactly how it works too, right? So this is just a really big, long phrase that could easily intimidate people, but it's just really... So I just actually wait for the day when some... a really loud-mouthed guy comes up to me and starts dropping all these big words, and he uses that. And I'll be just laughing at him. I'm like, you just showed your card. I now know how little you actually know, because I know exactly how that works. And it's actually good to learn these big words too, because when I teach a class for Andy or something like that, I'll use these big words, not so much because I want to show off I know these, but what I tell the students is that, look, you need to know the language of the game, really. Mm-hmm. You need to know the kinds of terms that are being used. And on top of that...
There's a lot of truth to that, by the way. That
right.
A lot of these things that we study, mm-hmm. it's like a language. You got to learn the language.
You got to learn the language. So you find that a lot of doctors, they use a whole nother language because they've learned all these medical terms that you don't typically use, right? And it's the same thing.
Which is funny, by the way, because when you learn the Latin for what they mean,
yeah.
It's like child language.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite funny.
It's yeah. often that way when you cross over into another language. For example, the word for ambulance in German is Krankenwagen, right? It literally means sick car.
Yeah.
Krankenhaus, yeah. Hospital, sick house. It sounds really simple, right? So I tell the students, look, you need to know the language of the game, and you also that way, when somebody comes to you and tries to intimidate you, you know exactly what they're talking about. To go with that, it's really helpful to know sort of the lay of the land, so to speak. When you get into a certain field that you want to study, say intelligent design or epistemology or whatever, you want to know what are the terms that are being used. And here's another thing that I find really important. You need to know the players.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Right. So for example,
absolutely.
We all know I'm sure we can all of us, especially us in Canada, we can at least pull out 2-3 names of hockey players, right? I know for the Canucks there's Alex Burrows or the Sedin brothers and things like that. You know, Roberto Luongo used to be with the Canucks. Now he's moved on. So I know some of these things in hockey. Well, how well do I know the players in theology or philosophy, right? On both sides. And one thing I found is really helpful is if you want to know who the players are, you want to look at the people that they're citing, right? The books that they're reading, and you find that.
By the way, there's a great tactic. When you read a book that's a great book, particularly if you're in college and you need to find more resources, you right. always go to the bibliography.
Oh, bibliography, man. Yeah. yeah.
Where are they reading?
Yeah, and if you start seeing the same name and the same book over and over again, you know, that's a must read.
Or one of the other things that I've often done is before I start reading a book, if I want to know, you know, what angles this person coming from or what kind of education mm-hmm. do they have, I read their bibliography first so yep. that I can see, you know, mm-hmm. again, where have they been reading.
And is it a book worth reading, right? Because if yeah. it doesn't even have an index, but it's supposed to be an intellectual, it's like, no, that can, yeah. that can, you can pass.
And then just a couple of quick points before we wrap up today. Don't try to understand everything. Sometimes when you read something through the first time, because you're not familiar with it, all you want to do is just get the basic framework. Okay, these are some of the arguments they're using. I don't understand the arguments, but these are the arguments. But then later you come back to it and you say, okay, how does the premise one work? How does premise two work? How do they connect? And how do you infer the conclusion? That sort of a thing. So come back to something multiple times. There were episodes from Reasonable Faith that I had to listen to a number of times before it clicked.
Do you know how many times there are talks by JP in the area right. of philosophy of mind, mm-hmm. you know, especially the languages used in philosophy of mind? I find that particular field has a lot of its own mm-hmm. lingo. But I had to listen to it multiple times.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes you find that because you don't know the language, it's just inaccessible to you. In that case, you start looking up some of those words and what
That's
they
right.
mean, and you find that more and more you start to understand what they're saying.
I remember too. There's certain books that, for example, Plantinga's some of his works. I've had to read multiple times.
Mm-hmm. And the last point that I want to leave with our listeners is, when we think of studying things, we always think about studying the content of it, right, of something, the what of. I am convinced that it's also very helpful to study how to study. We don't often look up things on YouTube, for example, you know, how to take notes, right? Well, what's the Cornell note-taking method? What does that look like? What's the Pomodoro technique? Things like that. So you definitely want to, I'll put some of these on the show notes, but again, look up how to study, right? And that's really going to help you in the long run, especially if you've been out of school for a long time and you want to come back into studying. Study how to study, and that will really yeah. go a long way as you start
one your thing journey. That I'll never forget that shaped me in this regard was I came into a class, I had a class with J.P. Moreland. And the first day of class, he came in with this book that was held together with rubber, I kid you not, rubber bands and duct tape, you know. Wow. And he waved it in front of us. And he, you know, he's an expert in philosophy of mind, but he waved, you know, the textbook at us. Said, listen, if I had to read it this many times, I mean, how many times are you going to need to read it? Like, this isn't a one and done, right? You come back to it multiple times.
Right.
Cool.
Okay, so these are some pointers. I'll summarize all of it on the show notes. And hopefully those will be helpful to you. And if you have any questions, comments, concerns, threats, humorous anecdotes, feel free to give us send us an email at steve@apologeticscanada.com or info@apologeticscanada.com. And we'll see you next week with part 3 of How Then Shall We Live.